Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the government shutdown. While Yosemite is closed, the president's health law is still moving forward, at least here in California. We'll talk to California's Health and Human Services Secretary Diana Dooley and find out what the launch today of the new health insurance exchange Covered California means for you. There's also one group of Californians who might be surprised to learn they qualify for health coverage under Medi-Cal. We'll tell you why people who call themselves dreamers can now get health insurance from the state. And we'll talk politics with Bill McEwen, editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee. That and a look at something called the Span Spec Festival. It's bringing music and art to the small valley town of Orosi this weekend, and we'll get a preview. That and more coming up next on Valley Edition, right after these news headlines.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. California programs and services won't take a big hit from a federal government shutdown, at least not at first. But state budget watchers still say California has a lot to lose from the standoff in Washington, not just from the shutdown, but from the upcoming debt ceiling fight as well. Jason Sisney, with the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office, says both battles could do severe harm to California's recovering economy.
California has really moved its budget in the right direction in recent years. And at the same time, that momentum is threatened to some extent by the inability of decision makers in Washington to reach agreement.
Sisney says a prolonged federal standoff could reduce state revenues and push the state back into a deficit. The governor's Department of Finance says all state programs and services have enough funding to keep operating for the next month. After that, some programs like food stamps and school lunches could run out of money. The effects of the government shutdown can already be felt in Central California, where three national parks have begun to close their doors to many who have planned trips months in advance. A group of artists is gearing up for a cross-country road trip that will end in California. It's part of a project to mark the 75th anniversary of John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. Steve Milne reports.
The trip starts Friday in Oklahoma, retracing the path the Jode family took along Route 66 in The Grapes of Wrath, with stops in New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas.
We are, as much as possible, trying to follow the original Route 66. It's a little complicated. There are parts of the route that don't exist anymore.
Elizabeth Weldon Smith is helping to organize the road trip. She's with the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas. Smith says they're taking three artists along.
A filmmaker, a visual artist, and a playwright. They're going to be stopping in different communities and talking to people and collecting everyday American stories of how they get through hard times.
Those stories will be showcased at the Steinbeck Festival in Salinas next May. The road trip ends in a migrant labor camp in Arvin, California, near Bakersfield on October 14th. In Sacramento, I'm Steve Milne.
For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Every few months, we like to take a moment and talk about politics with various guests from throughout the Valley. Joining us now to do that, we have Fresno Bee's editorial page editor, Bill McEwen, joining us. Bill, thanks for stopping by.
And thanks for having me here today, Joe.
It's a great day to talk politics. The government shutdown is underway, and the Valley has an interesting role to play in this. Some comments in the New York Times today from Valley Congressman Devin Nunes really caught some attention. Nunes was quoted as talking about his fellow House Republicans who are pushing for the shutdown and have been pushing for the shutdown. He compared them to, quote, lemmings with suicide vests. He said they have to be more than just a lemming because jumping to your death is not enough. Your thoughts on Nunes and his statements here?
Well, Joe, this actually has been brewing for quite a while, and Representative Nunes has made similar comments when he's been here in the Valley during the congressional break. And I know he's frustrated to a degree that are worried about this is really going to hurt the Republican brand and hurt the Republicans going forward. At a recent Eggs and Issues breakfast for the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, he made similar statements, and he said that, you know, America voted on this when they reelected Barack Obama as president, and that it was the course that the Tea Party Republicans were taking was hurtful to the Republican Party and also hurtful to the American economy. And he was basically saying, get over it. Not that he's endorsing Obamacare. He says he sees a lot of problems. I think he used the term train wreck, which is a popular phrase used by opponents of Obamacare. But he said this wasn't the time to try and address this. And he was highly critical then. And I think events of the last couple of years have been interesting because Congressman Nunes was regarded as one of the most conservative members of Congress. And now, by today's standard on the right, he might be a middle-of-the-road Republican in comparison to some of the real firebrands that are out there.
Yeah, you have Nunes saying, you have this group saying somehow if you're not with them, you're with Obamacare. If you're not with their plan, exactly what they want to do, you're with Obamacare. It's getting a little old. So to some degree, he's been outflanked on his right in not just this issue.
Absolutely. And I think another thing's going on here, which is, one, the congressman serves on the House Intelligence Committee. That's a big assignment. So I think there's more gravitas. He's a little more sober than he has been in the past just because of the issues he's dealing with in regards to terrorism and wars around the world. The other thing is, you know, he's a key player in trying to get this new free trade pact going with the European Union. And again, this is one of those few initiatives that the Republicans and President Barack Obama agree on. And because of that, Congressman Nunes finds himself working with Democrats on this trade issue. And he told me recently that sometimes some days he feels like some of his better friends are Democrats. And I never thought I would hear Congressman Nunes say that.
It does seem surprising.
And I don't want to misrepresent. This was in regards to this trade issue.
Okay. Definitely understand where you're coming from with that comment. But even on things like water, Nunes has had some interesting things to say in terms of the overall battle and how this fight has not accomplished anything so far.
Well, what he said at the Eggs and Issues breakfast was that the environmentalists basically have eaten the right for lunch. And he said they're more unified, they strategize, they've done a good job of divide and conquer. And again, here the congressman is frustrated in that he believes that those that are seeking more water for agriculture are so divided among themselves. They're never going to be able to mount an effective fight in regard to this. And he went so far as to call some of the water districts in the valley greedy. In other words, putting their own interests ahead of, let's say, agriculture in general.
Well, there's some interesting politics, both on the national level and on the local level going on there. Let's stay with Congress now and talk about some of the other things that are going on locally. I guess, first of all, do you hear any other similar rumblings from other Valley representatives with
No, I haven't. I mean, you know, a lot of the congressional delegation from the Valley, with the exception of Jim Costa, has been very involved in fighting high-speed rail. And, you know, they're clearly united on that front.
Definitely. There were maybe some sunlight in between the Valley congressional bloc, though, on the issue of immigration, which seems now to have died in Washington. But you had Representatives Valadao and Denham pursuing maybe more of a path towards citizenship, and Kevin McCarthy and Devin Nunes and others backing the enforcement first approach.
That you do. But again, both Congressman Nunes and McCarthy are on record as supporting immigration reform. What people would question is how hard are they fighting for it, and why have they been not out front and in the limelight because the need here in the Valley is so great. So I don't know that any duties have been divided up, but clearly Congressman Valadao has taken a much more aggressive approach, and I'm sure angered some in the Republican Party by saying that, you know, a path to citizenship has to be part of this. Congressman Denham has taken the same approach as well and been out front trying to urge immigration reform. Thus far, they haven't really been successful in convincing enough Republicans to come to their side. We'll see if House Speaker John Boehner is going to stick by what he has said all along, is that any legislation that he would put up for a vote in the House of Representatives would have to be supported by a majority of his party. In other words, his party would have to carry the day on that, and that hasn't happened so far.
We're talking politics, state and local, with Fresno Bee editorial page editor Bill McEwen right now. Sticking with Valadao, well, we're this 3 months away from 2014, which, of course, is an election year, and political types are already jockeying to fill in the various spots to challenge incumbents and the like, and David Valadao has been in the news nationally in that area. Veteran political analyst Larry Sabato has that district, California 21, on his list of districts to watch. He has it as leaning GOP, but there is a new name in the race right now that is exploring possibilities to run as the Democratic candidate, and that's Amanda Renteria from Farmersville.
Yes, and she's definitely running. I mean, she has a full-fledged campaign going. For example, yesterday her campaign office sent out a statement on the government shutdown, and of course was quite critical of it. David Valadao, I think, had a pretty easy time of it making the jump from the Capitol in Sacramento to Congress, and that John Hernandez, who was a surprise number two finisher in our top two primary system, woefully underfunded, not a resident of the district. So a lot of things going against him. Amanda Renteria, you know, she's someone who's been part of the game. She hasn't run for elected office before, but chief of staff for a senator in Michigan, and also has this athletic background. You know, she played basketball as a walk-on at Stanford, played on Stanford's great softball team, I think, for 3 years. So, you know, she's hardened by the crucible of Division I athletics. She knows the political game. And more importantly, Democrats believe that she can have a chance to win this. So she's going to get a lot of funding. And this is going to be a pretty tough battle. I think it'll be very important for her campaign to mount effective voter registration drive. The district is largely Hispanic, I believe three-quarters of the residents there. And so you can expect her to say that Congressman Valadao represents the entrenched power interests of the district, while she'll be a voice for the people. The challenge will be getting the so-called people to the polls to vote for her. We'll see if she's able to do that. But I expect her to be very sharp on the issues and to be a good in debates, if there are debates, and I expect her to have a pretty extensive ground game. We know that Congressman Valadao will have a strong ground game as well, and we know that, he's popular with voters. So this could be a tough one for him. Too early, really, to tell how it's going, and I would agree with Professor Sabato on that it's leaning to the GOP at this early point.
Yeah, looking at some of the other Valley congressional races or potential races out there, any that jump to your mind? Kevin McCarthy likely safe in his district, House GOP
likely
whip.
Safe, guaranteed safe.
But some other ones, Jim Costa years ago got a very strong challenge from Andy Vidak. Vidak, of course, now in the Senate. We'll talk about him in a bit.
Joe, what's happened there is people on the Republican side have taken a look at this and they're staying out. So I don't know that you're going to have a strong candidate running against Jim Costa. You know, there's this group in the Valley that just and I don't think that hate is too strong a word. They hate Jim Costa.
Lot of cotton trailers.
Yeah, they have all these signs up and down the Valley and even up into, the southern end of the Valley. When you go, let's say you're taking a drive out to the Delta, you'll see those signs there as well on the way to the Delta. And, they blame him for water shortages. I don't know that the congressman is wrote the Endangered Species Act. I know he didn't. I don't think he's a judge, a sitting federal judge who decides many of these issues. So the tenor now has gone away from water to his advocacy for high-speed rail. But a lot of people don't like him. They may not like him, but I don't know that you're going to have a strong candidacy against him. I know that Andreas Borges, who sits on the Board of Supervisors, Andreas didn't tell me this, but people that know him and, other people in political office had told me that he was looking at that seat. But I think he's made it pretty clear that he's not going to run. And in fact, there was an op-ed he wrote in the Bee in which he was championing his term limits and campaign finance limits proposal for the Board of Supervisors. You know, he stated that the only office he'd be running for in the future was the Board of Supervisors. So you can take him out of that. There will be a candidate. I don't think it'll be very strong.
Jeff Denham, his district's safe. He has a challenger, Michael Eggman.
Well, I think that one's interesting. And here's why I think it's interesting. The Democrats think they can win there, and part of that is that President Obama carried the district in 2012. They had a fairly strong candidate last time, Jose Hernandez, who had a great life story, but Denham was able to frame the debate there, and he was able to paint Jose, who is an astronaut, so he has a great life story as a carpetbagger. You know, he'd most recently lived in Texas. Also able to frame him as someone who was a handpicked candidate of the Democratic Party. I think that got some traction in the region. This is different because Michael Eggman is someone from the region. He's a beekeeper, so he's in ag, but he also grows almonds. So there will be some ag constituency support there. I think the other thing, though, is that his sister, Susan Eggman, is in the assembly, and she is a go-getter, and she is a dynamo. So I think there's going to be a little bit of transfer there and the expectation he can do the same thing. And where she's been very effective is portraying California as the tale of coastal California and inland California. And so she has been very aggressive in demanding that the Valley get the things that it needs to prosper. So I think there is some expectation there, or they'll be able to sell the idea that that Mr. Eggman can go to Congress and do those same kind of things.
Moving on, we saw a return of an old name in Valley politics sending out an email last week, and that's George Rodanovich talking about a possible run for governor. Long shot of long shots, perhaps?
Well, no. If he can get the funding, he can run. Odds of winning, 1 in 100, 2 in 100. Republicans are having a hard time with credible candidates to go up against Jerry Brown. And Abel Maldonado was out of the chute first, and his campaign's in utter disarray already. And so I think that George saw that void, and so he's doing what people call testing the waters, seeing what the reaction's going to be, see if there's going to be able to be financing. I also think that he's doing it to draw attention to what he's been involved in now, which is, family responsibility, raising of the family, two-parent family, those kinds of issues, which he's been involved in and he's pushing.
And turning now to more local issues for our Fresno County listeners, there's some supervisorial races that are coming up, and one of them that's caught my attention and many others is District 5, Debbie Puchigian, and a potential challenger from First 5, Executive Director Kendra Rogers, who had a very public clash with the supervisors recently over the construction of this planned new facility. Some would call it a palace for First 5 downtown.
Well, it wasn't a palace, but it came in under budget. Over budget, so the bids have to go back out. You have Mike Berg, who is on appointed to the First 5 Commission recently by Supervisor Borges. He's the superintendent at Central Unified. He has a background, strong background in school construction. Also knows daycare and early education. that's a good appointment there. And he's kind of going to be ramrodding this building going forward. I don't think there's any doubt that Supervisor Pachigian not happy with Kendra Rogers and others in this children's movement questioning her on a lot of issues. And so we're seeing some political payback here.
Yeah, and
I'm not sure that Kendra Rogers will run. I know she's talked about it. I guess she's taken out papers, but
it's a pretty high bar to go against a sitting supervisor, especially one named Pachigian.
Yes, and also Supervisor Pachigian is very popular in her district. So I don't think that Kendra Rogers will run.
Henry Perea gave his State of the County speech last week and definitely got some attention for what he had to say. And it's interesting the position he's staking out on growth and development in versus Fresno City and Fresno County. He's one of the biggest supporters of high-speed rail, but he seems to be backing away from some of the mayor's efforts on downtown revitalization. Usually those two things go hand in hand. Instead, Perea is very much in support of growth on the fringe, Fryant, Millerton, that area. Do you see this positioning, whether or not Perea plans to run against Swearingen's seat after she's termed out in 2016, do you see this positioning as being a preview of what the next Fresno mayor's race might have in terms of validation of Swearingen's priorities on downtown?
Well, I absolutely think that is going on. I mean, you're seeing pushback from the council. And I understand they feel the heat in their district of constituents say, well, what are you doing for me? Why are we spending all this effort downtown? And the mayor has to do a much better job of explaining why this is important. The other thing that's going on is, and Joe, I don't know if it's just, I hate to use the term Fresno factor, but let's think about this. This children's center in downtown Fresno, it's been on the drawing board for about 7 years. You're getting time when you're actually going to break dirt, and all of a sudden now it's an issue, and there's a chance it may not happen. You look at bus rapid transit. That's been on the drawing board through two mayoral administrations. There's no surprises there. I mean, it's always been, it's going to be the Kings Canyon corridor. It's going to be the Blackstone corridor. City of Fresno has gotten lots of federal dollars, and there's been a lot of effort in this, and now all of a sudden you have a city council saying, well, wait a second, we're not sure if we're all into bus rapid transit. We don't know if it'll work. We need to fix our bus system first. And, you know, that's always amazing to me because 7 or 8 years ago, why weren't you saying, let's fix our bus system first? So, you know, I don't know. Is this the Fresno factor where we say we're going to do something and we work towards it forever, and then at the last minute we shoot it down? I don't know. But I think you've hit the nail on the head, Joe, with saying that this next election, a big part of it in regards to the mayor's race, will be about downtown versus the needs of the rest of the city.
And before we go, one final thought. We lost two big names last week in Fresno politics, Fresno Valley politics and Valley leadership, and that's the deaths of George Zenovich, a former judge and longtime legislator, and also CSU trustee Pete Mias. Your thoughts on the legacy of both of those two gentlemen?
Well, one, George Zenovich, and you said long time. He was in Sacramento for 16 years. He got a lot of landmark legislation done. My other thought is that George Zenovich couldn't get elected today. You know, he was a musician. He was a little bit of a bohemian, is that the word? And I think opponents would pick those aspects apart to some degree, and also think the public, you know, we don't like our leaders to have fun anymore. And so I don't know that he could get elected today. The other thing is, of course, is he was able to stay true to his liberal roots while having a lot of friends on the Republican side. And he had those friends because of his ability to make a deal and also the ability to identify common interest. In the case of Pete Mias, just think what he took the Fresno County Office of Education, a sleepy little office that no one gave much thought to, gave it a high profile because of his political connections and his political savvy, able to bring a lot of funding to it. able to put on a lot of programs that smaller districts couldn't afford to do. So we saw expansion of vocational training, migrant education, programs for special education students. And the other thing about Pete is, it just hit me, in the couple days after the election, as you would have thought, everything he did was a success. But the fact of the matter is, his big goal, which was to be Clovis Unified Schools chief, he didn't get it. Later, when Fresno Unified was struggling to no end, he wanted to run Fresno Unified. He didn't get that one either. And yet at the end, he was so powerful in education, sitting on the CSU trustees and guiding that search that ended up with Joseph Castro succeeding Dr. John Welty. So to me, Pete's story is a lot about perseverance. And, the guy was just so well-rounded and so interested in so many things and tremendous amount of energy.
Well, it's a fascinating story and legacy. Both of those gentlemen felt for many years to come here in the Valley, and we'll continue to follow all of the political developments out there. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Our guest today has been Bill McEwen, editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk more about the expansion of health care coverage under Obamacare. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. When Californians start signing up for Obamacare today, one group has been told they aren't eligible for coverage. But a little-known provision in state law means that some young immigrants who come to the country as minors, specifically those who are covered under the Obama administration's Deferred Action Executive Order, actually are eligible for the state's expanded Medi-Cal program. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin brings us this report on a story that was first reported by New America Media.
The Deferred Action Program allows certain immigrant youth to remain in the country and obtain a work permit without fear of deportation. Here's President Obama describing the policy in June 2012.
This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people.
And they would have qualified for new health care options under the Affordable Care Act. That is, until the Obama administration announced last August a new federal policy. It explicitly excluded these youth from participating in the expanded Medicaid program or purchasing insurance on the state exchanges. Alvaro Huerta is with the National Immigration Law Center.
It really doesn't make any sense. You're excluding a population of very young, healthy individuals, generally, from the insurance pool, and that makes it actually more expensive for the rest of us not to have those folks included.
Here in California, there's a wrinkle in the law, and it dates back more than a decade. The 1996 Federal Welfare Reform Law barred lawfully present immigrants who have been here for less than 5 years from receiving any public benefits, from food stamps to health care to housing. The Golden State, though, took a different approach. Renee Malo is the Deputy Director of Healthcare Benefits and Eligibility for the State Department of Healthcare Services.
We have made a policy that for individuals that meet certain requirements, if they're here as legal immigrants, but they're under, say, the five-year bar, we have afforded them full-scope Medi-Cal services. And again, we pay for those with state general funds.
Essentially, that means that some young Californians who qualify for deferred action are already eligible for Medi-Cal in the Children's Health Insurance Program, so long as it's funded by the state and not the federal government. And even more will be eligible for expanded Medi-Cal in 2014, says Ron Coleman with the California Immigrant Policy Center. But he says they still can't buy insurance through the state exchange called Covered California, because it includes federal subsidies and tax credits.
They're actually eligible now for Medi-Cal if they are blind or disabled. And as part of the newly eligible population that will get coverage starting in January, if they're a single childless adult, up to 138% of the federal poverty level, they will also qualify for Medi-Cal.
That's good news for deferred action youth. But Luis Ojeda with the California Youth Immigrant Justice Alliance says many of them don't know about this opportunity.
We've been told, no, that Obamacare doesn't apply to us and that we still won't have access to health insurance.
Ojeda, who's 23, is from Colima, Mexico, and now lives in Fresno. He was approved for deferred action status in May.
So I think part of the reason why we are still uninsured and we still haven't taken advantage of this opportunity, simply a lack of knowledge.
As an advocate for the immigrant community, Ojeda says he's focused on pushing for immigration reform, the Trust Act, and driver's licenses. He says it's important to get the word out about the health insurance benefits available to youth with deferred action status.
I think there's a lot of advocacy work that goes on in our community in terms of trying to improve the well-being of our community. But really understanding that in order for us to do that, we really need to take care of ourselves.
Coleman with the California Immigrant Policy Center agrees there needs to be more outreach to these youth.
In California, a lot of these eligibility categories that had been preserved are not known to a lot of people. So I do think that there will be a need for a lot of community education for eligible DACA-approved individuals to sign up for Medi-Cal and get the access to health care that they'll need.
As Obamacare enrollment begins today, Malo, with the Department of Health Care Services, encourages everyone who needs health care to apply for insurance. She emphasizes that the information collected is only used for the purpose of determining eligibility. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Despite the government shutdown, here in California, Covered California, the state's health insurance exchange, begins enrollment today. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone reports on how the rollout of the Affordable Care Act compares to the last time the federal government made coverage available to millions.
Ever since the Affordable Care Act passed, health policymakers have been comparing it to another moment in history.
Is this the single most important step that we have taken on healthcare since Medicare? Absolutely.
The Affordable Care Act is the biggest change in healthcare since Medicare.
The most powerful law for reducing health disparities since Medicare and Medicaid were created in 1965.
The final Medicare and Medicaid bill passed both houses of Congress by an overwhelming vote.
It's been almost 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare into law.
July 30th, 1965, in Independence, Missouri.
Under Medicare, almost 19 million people aged 65 and older had new medical coverage.
Half the aged did not have health insurance coverage, and the half that did have health insurance coverage had very poor coverage.
Dorothy Rice was a director of health insurance research at the Social Security Administration when Medicare was created. She's now 91 years old.
We were all told in the Social Security Administration that we should come to work on that weekend when Medicare went into effect because we were going to have the doors knocked down by all these elderly, sick people. And you know what happened? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Rice says Medicare started smoothly. There were no implementation delays. She says enrolling in Medicare was simple. Eligible people were automatically signed up for hospital care. And to elect medical coverage, they signed a pre-printed card they received in the mail. Rice says the new federal health law will not be that simple.
Now that individual has to sign up, choose a plan, the best plan that they can get for the amount of money they're willing to pay. And if they don't sign up, then they will be penalized.
Enrollment may be more complex than early Medicare. But Rice and others say it's crucial that everyone sign up if the new system is to work properly.
Imagine if everybody simply waited until their house caught on fire, then called up the insurance company and said, you must sell me an insurance policy right now.
Jonathan Engel is a professor at Baruch College. He wrote a book about the history of Medicaid.
Clearly, the insurance company is going to go out of business in about 3 minutes, right? You can't just insure houses that are already on fire. You have to have people buying in before their house catches on fire.
Engel says this national health overhaul has other challenges. Medicare overcame initial opposition from physicians, but the resistance to the Affordable Care Act is unprecedented.
And I think we're at almost sort of a unique moment in our political history, the level of divisiveness and anger and hatred and distrust between the two ends of the political spectrum. I mean, I think this is where we have some people who are actively trying to make something that would naturally be difficult become more difficult.
Engel says people are largely uninformed and are being given misinformation about the law. He says the sheer complexity of the health exchanges is enough to scare people away, too.
Buying health insurance is complicated even for highly informed, sophisticated people. And for someone who really isn't used to having private health insurance, trying to figure out networks, bronze plans versus silver plans, in-network versus out-work network, deductibles, these are complicated problems.
Engel says it will take years to evaluate the success of the new program. Dorothy Rice says California's implementation of the law may go more smoothly because of the state's rigorous efforts. But she hopes eventually the national health care system will look more like Medicare.
We were sure that when Medicare was enacted, that it wouldn't be long before we would have national health insurance. But that never came to being until the 2010 Affordable Care Act.
The open enrollment period begins Tuesday, October 1st, and goes through March 31st of next year. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California launches its version of Obamacare today with the official debut of the state's health insurance exchange, Covered California. We're joined now by the chair of the exchange, Diana Dooley, California's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Of course, she's no stranger to Central Valley listeners, a Hanford native. Dooley worked for years as a vice president at Children's Hospital, Central California. This afternoon, she'll speak at a launch event for the exchange at Fresno State. Secretary Dooley, welcome.
Thank you so much, Joe.
First of all, with the government shutdown that took place last night, does that impact your plans for rolling out Covered California in any way?
Not at all. The funding for this is secure. Money's in the bank. We're ready to roll and fund it through all of 2014. After that, it will be funded by the premiums paid into the program. So from a practical effect, it's of no consequence.
Obviously, this is a very big day for your department as people begin to sign up for coverage. Your staff has been working at a breakneck pace to prepare for this over the past few months. As I understand it, your plan to serve around 5 million Californians. How did this come together over the past months? Because I know it's been a real challenge in that regard.
Well, just as we thought we couldn't move any faster, we moved into warp speed. This has been, while I say that for enrollment and changing the healthcare, this is a marathon, not a sprint, it has certainly been a sprint for the last 3.5 years. It began under the previous administration. Governor Schwarzenegger supported and created the exchange and a program within counties for early enrollment for indigents. We've got about 650,000 people throughout California that are pre-enrolled in the Medi-Cal expansion, and nearly 1.5 million that will be enrolled in insurance product within the first year.
Now, you've also launched a major outreach effort as a part of the launch of the exchange, and by all accounts, it's needed. There's a lot of confusion about the law and about the expansion of coverage, even among people who know something about healthcare, let alone those who aren't paying very close attention to the law. What is the exchange doing to get the word out about the new plans that are being offered?
Well, healthcare coverage generally is complex. Each of us that are lucky enough to have employer-sponsored insurance knows that every year at open enrollment, we sometimes need help from our human resources staff to go through the form and see what's available. That kind of support will also be provided to uninsured and people who will be purchasing on the exchange, either for the first time having coverage or changing coverage because they'll be eligible for subsidies. We have nearly 7,000 insurance agents that have been certified and trained in this product to help. We've got nearly 10,000 people that work for local organizations, community groups, churches, schools, unions, business organizations, chambers of commerce. We've got a broad network of people that live and work in the communities that will reach out to people. They will be trusted resources in the communities. Then we've got the three service centers that will have telephone assistance and the web. People can go to coveredca.com and enroll themselves. If they get stuck, there's a phone number they can call. So we are still in the process of adding trainers. We have hundreds already trained. We will have thousands trained over the next several weeks and months.
What would you say is the biggest unknown at this point?
I think the mix of people who will join, it's one of the reasons that people worried that the insurance rates would be high. The insurance rates that we got from the plans when we negotiated were well below that was predicted, in part because there's a high level of confidence among the insurers that the outreach is going to be effective and that people will want to be insured when they have the opportunity. The marketplace itself is very user-friendly. It's the first time people will be able to comparison shop and actually see what they're going to get. There are no hidden rules or gotchas. Everyone will see what their premium is, what they'll have to pay when they go to the doctor, what their maximums are, and that will be uniform across the plan, whether you're going to Kaiser or Blue Shield or Blue Cross or Health Net. All of the major insurance companies have products available in the exchange.
So starting today, people can begin to sign up. Coverage starts January 1st. Walk us through this process for our listeners who might be interested in what the plans are and how they can consider if they're eligible and take part. What's the first step? What do they do?
One of the main differences, and there are many, is that there is an essential set of benefits. All of the plans will offer the same 10 basic benefits that include doctor visits and hospitalizations and pharmacy, mental health and substance use disorder. All of that is in the basic benefit. And they will be tiered from bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, depending on how much you pay and how much the insurance pays. So you'll look at it and you'll see how much you think you'll need to use health care and how much you want to pay. If you want to pay a low premium, you might pay a higher deductible. If you have a lot of needs, you might want to have less out-of-pocket, but you'll pay more each month. All of that will be displayed in a way that you can shop and compare. You will also be able to see which doctors and hospitals are in the network of your plan. So if you choose one particular plan, you'll know which doctors and hospitals are available to get your care. That is all available on the Internet, and as I said, there will be telephone support and assistance for people to answer questions. In order to get insured, it starts in January, so to be eligible for coverage in January, you must enroll by December 15th. So we have 2.5 months to get the first wave of people enrolled. And then each month, you must enroll by the 15th of the month to be eligible for the next month through the end of March. And then open enrollment will close, and there will be a standard open enrollment every year in the fall, just as there is for your employer-sponsored plans. You can't just wait until you have an illness or injury to enroll. You must enroll and be enrolled for that year for the coverage.
What about for people who think that they might be eligible for the Medi-Cal expansion? Do they call the same number? Do they go to the same website? What's the interface into the system for those people?
Yes, Joe, that is one of the other great advances of the Affordable Care Act is there's a single streamlined application, no wrong door. You can go to your county office, you can go online, you can phone, and you answer a few simple questions, and there is an indication whether you're eligible for Medi-Cal or whether you're eligible for insurance product. And there's a sliding scale depending on income. If you're eligible for Medi-Cal, you get enrolled right with that call. You may get transferred to a county office in your county of residence to do the enrollment in Medi-Cal, but it is through the same system. If you're eligible for insurance, you may be eligible for a subsidy. There's premium assistance. It's called the Advanced Premium Tax Credit, and you can have part of your premium paid depending on your income. All of that can be assessed through the internet access or through the telephone assistance or through the in-person assistance that's available through a variety of nonprofit community organizations and schools and churches. They will have trained employment counselors and also the county offices that currently enroll people in Medi-Cal have all been trained in the new products, and they are ready throughout the 58 counties to assist people with the enrollment.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with California Secretary of Health and Human Services, Diana Dooley, of course, no stranger to Central Valley listeners, a woman who has Valley ties, a native of Hanford, and a former administrator at Children's Hospital Central California. Secretary Dooley, at the same time that people are enrolling in coverage, I've talked to several people who, with private insurance, who have recently received letters from their insurers in the past few days notifying them that their coverage is being terminated because their plan, and most of these people have high deductible plans, doesn't meet the requirements of the new health law. And they seem quite surprised. They weren't thinking about looking at the exchange and these other things. They thought they would be keeping their insurance, keeping their doctor. What happened to these people and what should they do?
Well, there were several products in the marketplace that provided very little coverage, and many of these plans are what resulted in the medical bankruptcies, where people were paying a very small premium, and then they got sick or they had an injury and they had a hospitalization, and they end up with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in bills that they didn't think they had. And that is one of the things the Affordable Care Act addressed. They have 10 essential benefits, and every plan has to cover basic hospitalization, basic pharmacy, basic medical care that you would expect. And so many people live under the myth that they actually have coverage, but they do not. That won't be allowed, and that's under the federal law, that if you buy a health plan, you are going to get coverage if you are sick or injured. And so some of the companies that were selling very, very low-priced but low-benefit plans can't offer those plans any longer. Some of them have left the marketplace and they won't be offering individual coverage. But we have plenty of very good, reputable, excellent providers that are available through the exchange, and people will get what they pay for.
Aside from the political debate over the healthcare law, there are some actual serious questions about what the law will mean purely on a healthcare level and how the system is changing. On Monday, NPR published an online piece by a medical school professor from the University of Oklahoma talking about what he saw as some of the benefits and some of the drawbacks of the law. And he ended his piece with a lament about the demise of the private practice physician. And he said, the traditional doctor-patient relationship in which a single doctor gets to know you over years will become a luxury. Those who want a personal physician will have to pay extra for that service at some point. How do you think the relationship between doctor and physician will change? And are some of these concerns about the demise of the traditional private practice family physician, are those overblown?
Well, I think that there is confusion about the cause and effect. One thing doesn't cause the other. Much of the change in the delivery system is because medicine is changing itself, and there are significant differences between the way younger doctors want to practice and the way older doctors have historically practiced. Almost no young doctors go out into a practice by themselves. They appreciate collegial involvement. They want to be a part of a group. They work in large organizations of medical groups, independent practice associations, they're called. And there are many doctors working together, and there are many good things about the kind of collaboration that results from that. But the Marcus Welby visit at your home doctor does seem to be an issue of age, and younger doctors are not choosing those kinds of practices. So they are driving the change that the Affordable Care Act accommodates. There is much better coordination of care, and many private physicians provide excellent care, and they always have, and many people want to continue to have that kind of care, and they will be able to. But there is a significant change going on that the Affordable Care Act recognizes rather than necessarily causes.
One last question. Looking down the road a couple years, when we look back on this day years from now and on what's taking place now and through the rest of this year as people begin to sign up and people actually start to get coverage in 2014, down the road, what indicators should we look for to determine whether this has all been a success? Obviously, a lot of people are going to get coverage now. What other things should we look for in terms of evaluating the massive amount of work that's going on right now?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, I call a three-legged stool. The first and the most important, and the one we're talking about today, is the coverage expansion. And if we can significantly reduce the number of people who don't have the security that comes from knowing that you are not just one injury or illness away from bankruptcy, that will be a huge advantage. But the other two parts of the Act are also important, and we are employing in every way possible the tools that creates to both change the delivery system and the way we pay for care so that we are incentivizing wellness and not just paying for treatment, moving away from a fee-for-service basis so that care is coordinated and you are treated early in an illness and your chronic conditions are managed in ways that are both higher quality and lower cost. And the third part of the ACA promotes individual responsibility and wellness and fitness, and we're seeing a major revolution throughout the private sector. Businesses and local groups are sponsoring activities to better understand hypertension and obesity and exercise and nutrition. We work very closely with our agricultural partners, the State Department of Food and Ag, and our partners at the Department of Education for early intervention and food and nutrition. So there are many things about the Affordable Care Act that go well beyond the coverage expansion. But today we are celebrating a new state of health, a commitment to a culture of coverage, and that everyone can have a healthy future. So I thank you very much, Joe, for your interest in this and the support that you provide in helping people understand what both their opportunities are and what their responsibilities are.
Again, our guest today has been California's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Diana Dooley. She is also the chair of the state's new insurance exchange, Covered California, which launches today. Secretary Dooley will be speaking at a launch event for the exchange at Fresno State this afternoon. Secretary Dooley, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Joe. Bye now.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This Friday night, the small Tulare County town of Orosie will be home to dozens of rock bands and artists from across the valley for an event known as the Spanspec Festival. The event takes place at the Orosie Memorial Hall, and joining us now to tell us more about this event and how it got started, we have the two festival co-founders and co-directors. Welcome to our program, Cristobal Carrillo and Israel Flores.
Hello.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you with us today. How did this festival start? You're in your eighth year now. It seems like a lot of things start out for a year or two, then they may go away, but 8 years, that's staying power. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, it basically started as a forum for me and Cristobal to have a venue to play locally in our hometown, which is Orosie, and we used to play music and bands kind of when we were younger, and we ended up having to go to many places, you know, Fresno, Visalia, which were good, but we never really got to play in our hometown, so there was kind of a way for us to create a venue for music and arts for in a place where we lived at, where we didn't really see that often.
And turning to you, Cristobal, what did you envision when you first started this? What was the initial vision, and how has it grown?
You know, it's interesting. I think when we first started out, like Israel said, we really just wanted to create a place where us and our friends could come and play music for our friends. I think now it's grown into a lot, into a sort of community event where we really want to try to give back to the community that's helped us become who we are.
Orosi's kind of a small town. It's not necessarily the type of place that a lot of people would think of as having an arts festival, a music festival, something as unique as this. And you have bands coming in. There's some bands that have origins in Orosi. There's some bands that are from Fresno and other cities as well. Is there a perception that you have to get over there that Orosi can support something like this?
It's definitely been an uphill battle to try to sort of convince either people from Orosi and from outside that there's something very interesting going on. Because other than that, there's not that much that kind of compares. So it's a little strange. But, we've sort of made it work for the last 7 years or so.
Tell us about some of the bands that you have lined up. Israel, why don't you tell us about...
Sure. This is probably the year... This is actually definitely the year that we have the most acts in the one night. So we have 9 this year. And even last year, which was probably one of our bigger years, we had only 7. Names that probably the Fresno community might recognize is bands like Strange Mind, which is one of our favorites, and it's, I think, one of Fresno and just the Central Valley favorites. We also have Mezcal from Visalia, which is a pretty big sort of Visalia band. And then, like, as you mentioned, we do have a couple local bands. We try to put in as many local established bands from, you know, Cutler, Orosi area as we can. Obviously, that means that, you know, in the smaller town, there's not that many, but we have Werebear, which is part of Cristobal's band, and then Macondo, which is part of mine as well.
I have to ask the question, the name, Spanspec Festival, where does that come from? Is there a story there that you can share with us?
There is, and I think, at least on my end, I was trying to, we went maybe, I don't know, a month or so, or maybe longer, trying to come up with a name. And my idea was not to come up with the I wanted to get a name that was memorable. I mean, it might take a little bit to kind of work, but we had ideas like the Orosi Music Festival, but I wanted something that eventually you just point out to that name and then you'll know exactly what it is, even though you don't know what the name is. So eventually that's what we ended up with. And the name has almost nothing, or actually nothing to do with music or arts, but it comes from a friend of mine who knows South African dialect, and I just happened to be at a store with him, and Spanspec literally just means like cantaloupe, and I was walking by the supermarket with him, and he saw it, and he I guess he likes the cantaloupe, so he got excited and started yelling Spanspec, Spanspec, and I was like, what is that? It's like, oh, the cantaloupe. It's like, oh, okay. So that stuck in my head for like a year, and then eventually when we started thinking about names for the festival, I brought it up, and it sort of stuck. And now, people just say Spanspec, and it, at least to a good portion of people that have been there before, they know exactly what it means.
You have bands. Are there other things that are also going on as part of the festival?
Yeah, we invite a bunch of artists from around Fresno and Tulare counties to exhibit their artwork. We basically provide them a little area where they can set up all their work. Some of the people that are coming in particular that we're pretty excited about is Teresa Flores, who's a Fresno-based artist that currently lives in Los Angeles. She's going to be setting up her experimental quesadilla bar, I think.
Yes, this is probably the first time we'll have anything like this in Spanspec. We've worked with her before, but this sounds like a very, very interesting sort of out-of-the-box thinking of art, because she's like a almost traditional painter, but she's going to be cooking experimental quesadillas with anything that she can come up with and people can come up with. So it sounds very interesting. It's going to be fun.
I think the other thing we're really proud of is for the third year, we'll be having the Orosi High School, or students from the Orosi High School Art Department, showcase some of the works that are created specifically for the festival.
We managed to partner up with the High School Art Department, and now the teachers at the department are very excited about the festival. So they usually like work sort of around it, and they'll make like projects based on the date of the festival, and then the kids come and show their stuff. So that's pretty fun.
Well, it's very exciting. If listeners are out there and they want to attend the event, what can they do?
Well, probably to get all our information, you can go to our website, www.spanspecfestival.com. You can find all the information there. It's going to be this Friday, October 4th, 6 p.m. at the Orosi Memorial Hall. It's $5 in all ages.
Well, it's very exciting, and I'm sure it's a labor of love for both of you. Again, joining us today, we just heard from Israel Flores and Cristobal Carrillo. They are the co-founders and co-directors of the 8th Annual Spanspec Music and Arts Festival. It's this Friday night at the Arosi Memorial Hall. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. And for those of you on Twitter, follow us at kvpr. For reporter Rebecca Plevin, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.